as well-intentioned as the people are, and as hard as they work, and as much as they care, I think in general, we're an industry of low-hanging fruit. You know, if Tim Tebow is the topic of the day, we're going to beat it to death. If Tom Brady's the topic of the day, we're going to beat that to death. And I think we've got smarter people listening and watching to what we do, and I think we can do smarter programming.
Welcome back to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where we interview members of the sports media about their work and interesting people about the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. Today, my producer is Jamie Lasante, filling in for Bette Marston. And our guest is Mike Mayock, the excellent NFL Network analyst, best on-air draft specialist in the business, in my opinion. You've also seen Mike do Notre Dame games for NBC, NFL games for the NFL Network. Has had a long career as well, grinded his way up, worked for CBS on the NCAA tournament. I think he even did some stuff for SportsCenter way back in the day. So he's had an interesting career, and he's really worked hard to get where he is, which is now, at least in my opinion, the foremost television NFL draft expert. Want to thank everybody for the great feedback that we've been getting on the Sports Illustrated Media podcast. Our last two guests were Bomani Jones and Ian Dark. Feedback was great. I appreciate both those gentlemen coming on. Really enjoyed those conversations. We love hearing from listeners, so you can hit me up on Twitter at Richard Deitch, RichardDeitch. Feel free to give Jamie Lasante a Twitter follow as well. I will take any suggestions for future guests you have or any questions you would like me to answer in the future about this podcast. Please feel free to hit me up. If you like the show, share it with your friends. We are on SoundCloud, and you could subscribe to the show on iTunes. That would be awesome if you did. All right, Mike Mayock is, I believe, at his home just outside Philadelphia. Mike, good morning, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thank you, Richard. I'm looking forward to it.
Mike, do you want to start off by doing some Sugar Hill gang lines, or you're okay?
WEFUNK, better known as Lee Funk, or deeper still, the Mothership Connection, coming to you on 5,000 kilowatts of P-Funk power.
It's one of my
That's about all I have today.
Yeah, it's one of my I enjoyed when you did that on the NFL Network, and I think I enjoyed even more your daughter basically calling you out for that. That was nice. It's a good move.
She spent about all 27 years of her life calling me out. It's kind of interesting.
Nice. All right, you're an interesting guy, Mike, because I think in terms of defining what you do in broadcasting, you do a lot of unique things. So I can define you as an analyst, be it NFL or college football. I can define you as a draft expert or an NFL draft analyst. But I want to start off by asking, how do you define what you do in broadcasting?
I'm just a football guy, is the way I look at it. And in the broadcasting world, we've got college analysts, we have NFL analysts, and more we have draft analysts. And pretty much everybody only does one of those things. And I'm the son of a coach, and I like going to a high school game as much as I like going to a college or NFL game. And from my perspective, I take a lot of pride in trying to understand all those things, the differences at the different levels. I love the draft because, for me, it brings together all the tape work I do on both the college and the NFL guys. And because I'm forced to do both college and NFL games, or at least in the past I have, and I watch a lot of that tape, the draft is what kind is the glue that kind of pulls up both of those worlds together for me. So I love the fact that I'm able and typically have the opportunity to do all of that.
Mike, do you think your versatility has helped your career, or would you have been more helped by being specific to one thing, be it college football only, be it NFL only, be it NFL draft only?
Richard, I really think I had to be versatile because I wasn't a big-name former player. And you know, I tore my knees my third year in the NFL, and I was done by the time I was 25. I spent 18 years in commercial real estate while I was trying to figure out how to break into the broadcasting world at a significant level. So there's kind of one road to success if you're a former Hall of Fame player or coach, and it's much less defined if you're not. So I kind of had to do anything anybody asked me to do, and I did sideline stuff. I interviewed mascots. I pretty much had to, you know, I did a thing called Tour Across America, a minor league baseball presentation by ESPN years ago. So I had to do whatever they asked me to do just to get my kind of get a foothold in the industry. And I think as I progressed, the fact that I had to do it the hard way has helped.
Mike, am I correct that you at one point were a reporter on CBS's NCAA basketball tournament?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, I was. And when I did 3 years, I think, doing CBS college football in the mid-90s, 96, 97, 98, and they knew I was a gym rat in basketball. I loved basketball. I was a pretty good high school player. I played pickup basketball every day of my life growing up. And the fact that I got to sit there on the sidelines and listen to, say, Sean McDonough and Bill Raftery do the game, and then I got to interview Rick Pitino on his way in or out of a locker room. I got to hang out. I loved it. I mean, I'm just kind of a sports rat, a gym rat, and for me, that was really cool.
Any of those games turn out to be particularly memorable, a buzzer beater or a coach saying something that still stays with you this many years later?
Yeah, I remember Kentucky versus Utah, and I think I might be wrong, but I think they were in the Elite Eight, winner went Final Four. And again, I'm a coach's son, and I don't care what the sport is. I recognize good teachers. And I remember going to Kentucky's practice with Pitino. I remember going to Utah's practice with Rick Majerus. And Rick Majerus really made an impression on me as a teacher. And I remember sitting in the stands with him watching another team practice that was in the tournament. And he was just helping me. And he would say, okay, what do you see right now? And I didn't, you know, I'm like, coach, I'm a football guy. And he's, no. You're an athlete. Think about it. What do you see? What do you hear? And I said, I'm not really sure what you're getting at, coach. He said, listen, listen. And he said, the whole point is that team right there is not communicating. Even though it's a walkthrough, I don't hear a thing from their defense on switches. And he said, what that tells me is if and when I play that team, I know what I'm going to do, and I know how we're going to beat them. And that's made an impression on me because I love listening and watching great coaches coach, because to me, the essence of coaching at its simplest is teaching.
That's interesting. I wonder if the Majerus teams you saw were the Keith Van Horn teams that he had in the late to mid-90s.
It was, I think it would have been somewhere in that 96 to 99 range.
Right.
And they were really good, and I thought they were just one of the best coach teams I had ever seen in any sport.
Yeah, that's a great story. Mike, I'm going to ask you what the most enjoyable part of broadcasting is and what the least enjoyable part. So let's start with, what is the most enjoyable part of sports broadcasting for you?
For me, it's doing a game. Whether it's a college game or an NFL game, I like to smell the grass. I like to be around the coaches and the players a couple days before the game. I love watching the film on campus or at stadium. Excuse me. And the best thing for me, Richard, is there's all kinds of production meetings and all the stuff where the producers and directors talk about what you have to say or what topics you have to hit or how many camera angles there are. But all I know is when they finally kick the ball in the air to start the game, I look at it like it's now my game. You either know what you're talking about or you don't. There's no way to further prepare for it. They can't tell you what to say or what not to say. The ball goes in the air. And you either know the game, you know the teams, you know the players, or you don't, and you have to react on the spot. And I just love it. I love being a part of that whole process.
And what for you is the least enjoyable part of broadcasting?
Probably production meetings. You know, when you sit in a room and as well-intentioned as the people are and as hard as they work and as much as they care, I think in general we're an industry of low-hanging fruit. And, you know, if Tim Tebow is the topic of the day, we're going to beat it to death. If Tom Brady's the topic of the day, we're going to beat that to death. And I think we've got smarter people listening and watching to what we do, and I think we can do smarter programming rather than just beating the same thing to death. So I sit in these production meetings, and I often just kind of roll my eyes like, oh, really? I mean, are we going to talk about that again? Can't we get a step further than that?
That's interesting. Why do you think ultimately there's a tendency to go to the, you know, as you describe it, low-hanging fruit or the same six or seven topics that we often see on sports television often?
I think it's self-perpetuating. I think if it's a football story and ESPN is covering Tom Brady with a bunch of reporters and then we're going to do that. And so's Fox Sports Net. And I think the ability to get access to these big name guys. Oh, we got this guy. We got that guy. We're going to promote the fact that we got this guy. And I think it creates a frenzy like, oh my goodness, we're not covering this thing the way we should. And sometimes I turn on the programming, regardless of the station or the network, and I just go, I've heard this 100 times. I've heard it 100 times over the last 3 months, and I'm so tired of it. I mean, can't we get beyond that? And it, unfortunately, I think because we perpetuate it amongst ourselves, it gets even worse and grows even more.
Mike, you've worked with a number of different play-by-play announcers. And so, you know, whether it's Nestler or anybody else you've worked with, is there a common thread to the ones that that you've enjoyed working with and the ones that you think are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think the common denominator is that most of these guys grew up loving sports. They had a passion for it. The really good ones, you know, wanted to be players or coaches, realized at a certain point that probably wasn't going to happen, but still loved the sport so much and all sports so much that they had to find a way to stay involved. And regardless of whether they went to the Newhouse School at Syracuse or they did it by growing up the hard way, going from one town to another, market to market, I think the common denominator is the passion these guys have. And I'm telling you, I've worked with some great guys that love the game. And in addition to the passion, they're all incredible work ethic guys. They're so well prepared, whether it's Nestler or McDonough or, you know, I watched Tirico or Michaels or what. All these guys are just so well prepared, and you can tell they have a passion for the game.
Mike, you've worked for multiple outlets, or many, you know, I don't even know how many would it be, but you've worked for a lot of different sports broadcasting outlets, including the NFL Network, obviously recently NBC Sports. How, from what you've been able to ascertain, how different are the cultures at each place? Are they different, or are they the same? And if so, how are they the same?
Now, I think years ago when I first kind of broke in, I think there was the major distinction between network and cable. And, you know, the network perception was more money, treated people better, had bigger events to cover. And I was doing some games for ESPN when ESPN2 came out. You remember they called it the Deuce?
Right.
And, you know, you went from wearing a coat and tie to wearing something casual, which I felt silly at that point.
You didn't wear a leather jacket on air, Mike? Like,
I'm telling you. I mean, a couple times, one producer had me interview Wayne Gretzky's statue in Edmonton, which was humiliating. And you know, just climbing up next to his statue and interviewing, I mean, it was ridiculous. But point being, there was kind of a differentiation between network and cable. And I think as the years have passed, and you're talking about 15 to 20 years later now, that's blurred a lot. And there are different opportunities and ways to get into the profession, and there are different ways. You know, it's just amazing what technology has done and how the world is different now. So I think a lot of things have blurred, and I think at the end of the day, for me, regardless of what the outlet is, whether it's cable, network, whatever, it's just, what's the quality of the event you're about to cover and how much do people care? And I think the common denominator, again, reason why people get in sport, whether they're producers or directors, they have a passion for it. And that's what draws me back to the industry is people love what they do.
Mike, I feel like if you can get some answers out of a statue, then you can handle Greg Popovich and Bill Belichick would be my thought there.
I got no answers out of the statue. I felt silly. I felt stupid. I thought it came across stupid. And, memory.
I'll see if I can find that somewhere on YouTube.
No, please don't.
Will you be doing Notre Dame games this year?
No, I will not.
Why do you think you will not be doing them, in your opinion?
I'm sorry, you said this year?
Yeah, this year.
I had 1 year left on my contract. I think NBC went in a direction where they felt like Doug Flutie up in the booth and me on the sideline was a better presentation for them. I disagreed. And I think going forward, I have total respect for NBC. They've been really, really good to me. But I think for my career, what I need to do, I needed to go one way, and they felt strongly about going another way. So I think both parties parted with a great deal of respect for each other.
Mike, is it of your interest to do college football again in some form or fashion, independent of where that network would be?
Yeah, I mean, the way I look at my future is that best case scenario, I'd love to do games in the fall, and I don't care whether they're NFL or college, but I'd love to do a full slate of games in the fall at a high level, and then come January, I'd love to just go 100% full speed ahead on the draft, and to me, that would be an ideal schedule.
I'm going to get to the draft in a couple minutes, because obviously people know you from that. You've done incredible work. I'm not saying anything I haven't written. I think you're far and away not only the current best NFL draft analyst, but personally the best one I've ever seen in broadcasting, because I respect your work as a grinder and because I think you're always thinking of the viewer first and foremost. But I do want to ask you something about your game analyst work, because I saw something, and I'm not sure if you did, a couple weeks ago, where Dick Ebersol, the former head of NBC Sports, former NBC Sports executive producer, made the claim that he thought you used too much jargon on a broadcast. And you have probably been, this isn't new to you, there are some people who've claimed that you talk too much on a broadcast. I would disagree with that. I like what I hear. But on that topic, have producers spoken to you at all about the amount of words or football nomenclature that you use during a broadcast?
And I think, Richard, I think there's a fine line. And what I never want to be is a gadget or gimmick guy. And I can have some fun with heavy-legged waistbenders and all kinds of different kind of coach or scout speak that I'm privy to. But I think the important thing to me is, again, to recognize the intelligence of the audience and try to help them learn why a play worked or didn't work. And the jargon thing, I understand that any analyst has to speak to a level where even a person that doesn't understand much about football can understand. So if I drop in, hey, the three technique, and what I always try to do is make sure that I follow that up with, that is the defensive tackle lined up on the outside shoulder of the offensive guard. So I think whenever you get into verbiage, you have to be careful about defining it efficiently and quickly. And I know I talk too much sometimes. I get excited. I get carried away. I love what I do. And I think it's something I've always been aware of, but it's an incredibly difficult thing to monitor while you're on a national telecast, trying to parse every word that comes out of your mouth. And it's just kind of the way I talk. And maybe it's because I talk with so many coaches, scouts, general. It's part of who I am. And I don't want it to be a gimmick, and I don't want to talk over anybody, because ultimately what I want to do is be a good teacher. But I'm very aware of it, yes.
I realize that this is would be more of a question for NBC Sports Management, but do you think that played into them switching up the arrangement last year with Notre Dame and maybe you mutually parting ways this year?
I think it played a part. And again, yes, you're right. You'd have to talk to NBC management, but we had conversations. I had conversations with people who, I'm highly respectful of what they wanted, but I'm also respectful of, there's a reason there's a reason I got to where I got to as far as being able to do games. And I kind of have to be true to who I am, which again goes back to your first question, how do I view myself? And that's as a football guy. But you also have to be a communicator. And I want to make sure I'm being fair to both sides of that. So NBC had an opinion, which I respect. And at some point, I still had to be who I am, which is a football guy that uses some vernacular that hopefully tries to explain that. And it's up to NBC to decide if I fall short. And, you know, that's their call, not mine.
I appreciate you answering that, Mike. Thank you. Moving on to the draft, people who contact me on Twitter or email, they're always curious about how much the on-air people know about the picks during the draft. There's always a thought that, you know, whether it's you or Mel Kiper, Todd McShay, that you guys are tipped. You know, producers will tell you that's not the case. You guys will say that's not the case. For people who are listening, Mike, can you give us a sense of during the draft what you know prior to any of the picks and what you don't know?
I can't speak for anybody else. I mean, for what we do at NFL Network and what I'm used to, we're kind of in a bubble. And I kind of laugh because sometimes, and I didn't even realize, Rich Eisen kind of told me a couple of years ago, he's like, Mike, some of that stuff's out there on Twitter before we even get to the pick. And I'm so kind of zoned in on it. What my whole thing during the draft is, I'm trying to be the general manager for 32 teams. And I'm just constantly looking through my binder, trying to think ahead to the next pick and see how many offensive linemen have come off the board, who's next, what's a logical play. You know, the 17th pick is up, coming up, okay, what's a logical train of thought here for this general manager? To me, a couple years ago, some of our information guys were getting tweets from war rooms, and we were saying who it was. And to me, that takes all the fun out of it. You know, I put in months and months of work, and I just would like to know if I'm any good or not. And more than that, I'd like to just pass it along to the public, because this is what I think, and I could be wrong.
Mike, should viewers judge you on your final first round mock draft and how you do, or should they more judge you during the broadcast, what your evaluation is after the pick is made?
you know what? The mock draft thing is really interesting to me, and it's a useful tool for me as I prepare. I do a ton of private mock drafts where I might even draw three columns, and I'll start it off, and I'll go one, two, or three picks, you know, and then I'll think there's a pressure point with the fourth pick where they could go this way or that way, and then I'll have two lines going down where I do two mock drafts from the fourth point on, and then maybe at the 12th pick, I think there's another pressure point, and I'll add a third column, and it's just, it's a great way to think through what happens if this happens versus that happens, and so to answer your question, the number you get right in your mock draft to me means nothing. If something happens out of the blue that just surprises everybody, it just can completely obliterate the rest of the first round. And I think what's more important is understanding team needs, understanding what players fit schemes, and trying to get the guy at home to understand why a pick was made or not made. And every once in a while, when you kind of wonder why that pick was made, in a positive manner, just kind of say, hey, that surprised me, and here's why.
Mike, what's the toughest position to evaluate in the NFL for the draft, and why?
I think the first part, it's always been quarterback. You look at the history of first-round quarterbacks, and regardless of how much work and energy NFL teams put into them, you know, at best it's still a 50-50 proposition in the first round. I think with today's era in college football of the spread offense, it's changed the evaluation process at many positions. So I think the quarterback is the hardest because you're not finding many, quote, NFL-type throws. The funny thing is, I mean, the last few years, and I'm a former safety, you would think that safety would be the easiest for me to evaluate, but because of the way college football's evolved, and it's, I can watch a safety play four or five games sometimes and not have a clue whether or not I like them or not. And it's just because of the way college football is going right now.
Mike, are you already looking at potential people for the 2016 draft, or does that start occurring in September when the games start this year in college football?
Yeah, the draft for me all depends on my fall schedule. And what happens is in August, July and August, I start getting lists from some of my friends around the NFL that help me on the upcoming college seniors and the rankings of the college seniors to be this year. And I don't really start watching any college tape until typically October 1st. And at that point, again, if I had a couple of years ago when I had Thursday Night Football and Notre Dame, I couldn't even get to any draft work till January. And that's okay. That's what it was. This year, what I'm hoping to do is about October 1st, I'm going to start going through the top five players at each position, rising seniors, and I'll watch a game or two from last year, and then I'll have the September tapes from this year to watch and compare. And then, so starting October 1st, my tape work will start, and that will continue throughout the fall, and then everything really intensifies in January because we have the All-Star Games culminated by the Senior Bowl. Then in February, obviously, the process continues with the Combine, and then in March, I'm on the road almost every day going to Pro Day. So it's a bunch of tape work in the fall, and then in January, it's a combination of tape work and travel.
Mike, this fall, or I should say this August, you will be working as an analyst on the Eagles television network. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Is this the have you done the – I feel like you've done the Steelers before. Have you done the Eagles before?
Actually, I did about 5 years for the Vikings.
Vikings. I'm sorry. That's right. Okay.
And loved it. They were great to me. I established a great relationship with Rick Spielman and the people in the personnel department and all their coaches. I loved it. They could not have been nicer to me. And I grew up in the Philadelphia area. When I was a little kid, like 10 years old, my dad was the offensive line coach at the University of Pennsylvania. and their home field was Franklin Field. And during that time frame, the Eagles were playing at Franklin Field. So my dad used to take me in on Sundays when he was doing his film work from the day before, and I could literally look out the window of his office and watch the Philadelphia Eagles play.
Wow.
So I kind of grew up as an Eagles fan, and for me, the ability to go back and do those games this summer, this August, is really exciting. And on top of that, they're one of the most intriguing teams in the league.
How did the job come about? How does one end up getting the Eagles analyst job for the preseason?
I don't know. I mean, you know, I go to some, a lot of, every year I'm at least two or three of their training camp practices, and I know their people fairly well. And I got a call in the off season from Chris Johnson, who runs their television group, and he asked me if I'd be interested in it, and what my schedule was, and would I be interested in. And I said, you know, it depends on the schedule and how many training camps I have to get to, et cetera. But I'd be very interested. And the opportunity to work with Scotty Graham, who's a play-by-play guy that's done a great job on Sirius Satellite, and he's a Philadelphia area guy. I mean, they're a class organization, and I'm excited to do it.
All right, Mike, a couple more here. One of the things that you obviously had no control over was when you were doing the Thursday Night Football package for the NFL Network, the league ended up negotiating with CBS to move the first part of those games to network, and obviously, understandably, they wanted more viewers, and it worked out for them. That's why they did that. But as part of that decision, CBS's broadcast team took over, so those games now are being done by Jim Nantz and Phil Simms. How disappointed were you? Because that wasn't necessarily an issue of performance. That was an issue of once the network was taking over, they were going to use network announcers.
Yeah, it's a good question. And in my mind, I look at it this way. I was highly disappointed, as was Brad Nessler, Alex Flanagan, all our production people. I mean, that was a blast. And I felt like we poured our heart and soul into it, and that we loved what we did. So from a personal perspective, I was highly disappointed. The flip side of that is there's some things in life you can control and some things you can't. And if they came to me and said, well, we're going to let you go because of your performance, to me that would be horrible. But that's not what happened. It was just something that was kind of outside of our control. And as frustrating as that is, when you realize there's nothing you can do about it, I think it's a little bit easier to move on.
Is it, you know, is there, I guess I'll sort of just ask this directly. Does the frustration also exist that you get to call the preseason, which is really interesting, at least for the Eagles, and you see how that team takes shape and you see these other teams come in, but then you're not calling games during the regular season after working those four games in the preseason?
Well, it all fits together. You asked me earlier in this conversation what my favorite thing was in broadcasting, and I said doing games. So I'm kind of going from a couple years ago where I had a package of Thursday night games and Notre Dame games to having nothing but the Philadelphia Eagles preseason game. So there's a high level of frustration because of that. And as excited as I am about doing the preseason, you always look forward to, you know, September, and whether it's the kickoff to the college season, which I get goosebumps about every year, or whether it's week one of the NFL season. Either way, I'm going to miss doing games.
Will you actively in the next couple of years pursue trying to get back to a regular college game analyst or a regular NFL game analyst, obviously within the confines of working for the NFL Network, which I would imagine you want to keep that relationship, and clearly they want to keep that relationship with you.
I really don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I have a year left on my NFL Network contract, and it's going to be an intriguing year for me. I don't know where it's kind of like what I said to you a little bit earlier on the podcast, and that is my ideal schedule would be a quality package of games in the fall, college or pro, followed by a heavy dose of the draft process from January all the way through, you know, May 1st. That would be my ideal schedule, and I don't know what's going to happen a year from now.
Is it fair to say, though, that the NFL Network, at least previously, was pretty good about letting you work for another network if it didn't impede your NFL Network job?
Yeah, they've been wonderful. And I have a high degree of respect for the way I've been treated by the NFL Network. I've been there since it started. So I don't know. Again, some things you control, some things you don't. And I'm looking forward to see how the next 12 months play out. I'm excited about it, and who knows what's going to happen.
Mike, how competitive are you with the ESPN draft analysts or any other draft analysts out there, including people who would love to get your job on the NFL Network?
You know, I'm a competitive person by nature, but you're talking about a subjective thing. It's not like going out and playing a game and there's a winner and a loser. It's subject to an awful lot of things, and everybody's got their own opinion. And where I've gotten to in my own career, in my own head, is control what you can control. Be the best you can be. Work as hard as you can work. Put it out there for people, and there are going to be people that love you. There are going to be people that hate you. There are going to be people that don't care. But all you can do is control the quality of your work. So that's the way I look at it. And Mel Kiper and I have been buddies for a lot of years. I see Todd McShay on the road. There are more and more guys doing it. And I think it's fantastic because it's good for the game. But as far as where I sit in with all these people, that's up for you guys to figure out.
All right, here's the last set of questions. 5 minutes left. You recently interviewed Bill Belichick for the NFL Network. I'll just ask it direct. Is he how difficult or how easy an interview is he?
I'll preface this by saying I played for Bill Belichick on the New York Giants, and I remember calling my father. Again, my dad was my high school coach. I remember calling my dad after about two New York Giants practices and saying, "Dad, there's a special teams coach who's also the linebacker coach who's the best teacher I've ever been around. He's unbelievable." And that was Bill Belichick. And so I played for him for special teams for a couple of years before I got hurt. I have as much respect for him as I do for any coach I've ever been around. I think he's one of the smartest men I ever met, and I think he thinks outside the box. And every time I'm around this guy, I feel like I learn more football, which to me, and you know, if you think about it, that's been one of the essences today of our conversation is teaching. And I learn from this guy. So I think Bill's one of those guys that if he thinks you have a passion for football, regardless of whether it's me or a 22-year-old Cub reporter from wherever, if it's a true passion for the game and you're not trying to get at him for something, if you're not trying to get in a roundabout way to deflate gate or anything, if you're just trying to learn the game, he's awesome. And he's been so good to me in interview situations, I can't even begin to tell you. So for me, as long as you respect the game, Bill's a wonderful interview.
So the open forum for Belichick in front of 30 reporters is absolutely going to be the worst forum then for him, is what you're saying, because he's never going to give anything up because does he think that is by the nature of it a combative situation?
I can't speak for Bill. I can just tell you that my reaction is that I feel like if you love the game and you truly are just asking about something to learn, he's awesome. And how he handles the other stuff is Robert Kraft said last week, "I don't want anybody talking about anything but football."
Right.
And, you know, that's right up the Patriot alley.
There are one thing that Chris Collinsworth told me a long time ago Mike, that I thought was interesting was he mentioned that to be a really good broadcaster, sports broadcaster, in his opinion, you had to stop being an ex-player or an ex-coach and being a broadcaster who once played or previously coached. And there's a difference there. It's sort of how you perceive yourself first and then what you did way back when second. That's a long preamble to ask, Mike. There's a lot of former coaches and former players who are on television, either in the game analyst position or the studio analyst position, from the Grudens to the Antonio Pierces to the, Ray Lewis's, name anybody. How objective do you think the NFL media, on-air NFL media, is as a whole? And can you truly separate yourself from the game when you are talking to viewers?
It's an interesting distinction, and I think each individual has their own fine line. And the way I kind of look at it when I watch television myself is I want to know how well prepared that guy is. And I get a little frustrated sometimes with what one of my mentors, Steve Sable from NFL Films, used to call the one-trick ponies, guys that played a position in the NFL that they were very good at, but they can only either talk about that position or themselves. They can't get beyond that. They don't care to learn to get beyond that. And that becomes readily apparent very quickly. And they're the guys that don't last very long. I think the guys that last long in this profession are the ones that are willing to, A, get beyond themselves, and B, understand that there's got to be a line in there where they're being honest with the viewer. You can't be a homer. You can't be an apologist. At some point, you've got to be as honest as you can be in whatever positive direction you are. You don't want to be a negative guy, you scream, but you've got to find your own line of integrity. So it's about, to me, it's about knowledge and integrity, and everybody's got their own line.
Final two questions, Mike. Recently, the news came out that the Oakland Raiders named Beth Mowins as their play-by-play announcer for the preseason. That will make her essentially the first woman to call NFL play-by-play since 1987. Gail Sirens did a game for NBC last game of the season and then never called another game again. In your lifetime, Mike, do you think we will see a woman calling the NFL on a regular basis?
I don't see why not. You can tune into ESPN and hear a couple different female voices on college games. And is it Beth that sits next? Who sits next to Chris Spielman? In the past.
Well, Pam Ward and Beth Mowins have been the two in the last 10 years who have called college football for ESPN.
I mean, Chris Spielman's as much an X and O guy as there is out there, and if he and Beth or Pam can sit down together and do a game and do a great job of it, well, why? Again, I don't really care if you're male, female, black, white. I don't care about any of that stuff. I just care about what you bring. You know, I don't care how big a name you were or not big. What do you bring for that 3-hour broadcast? And is it a good listen? Is it seamless? Do you know your stuff? Have you prepared? Have you done the background work? That's all that matters, and that's all that should matter. And I'm hoping that, in my lifetime, we get to the point where it doesn't matter in any sense, not just male, female, not just black, white, just great player, bad player. Let's get the best people out there so we can all enjoy the telecast better.
All right, Mike, here's the final one. I know you're a Philly guy. Philadelphia sometimes gets some bad PR when it comes to their city as a sports city and sports fandom. So I'll give you the mic, Mike, and you can let me know why Philadelphia is such a great sports town.
Philadelphia is as good a sports city as there is in the country. The Philadelphia fan is passionate. Philadelphia fan is knowledgeable. And what happens is that the very few fans that we have are bad fans, are so bad that it gets blown out of proportion for years. And we got to hear about Santa Claus and snowballs and for years and years and years. But at the end of the day, 99% of the Philadelphia sport fans are passionate, they're knowledgeable, and I think you have to love that.
Living in New York, it's always these eastern cities are great. Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. It's good to be a sports fan around here. All right. The guest has been the NFL Network analyst Mike Mayock. You've heard him over the years on their draft coverage. You've heard him do Notre Dame games for NBC. You've heard him do the NFL games on the NFL Network. He even told you a story about his glory days interviewing Wayne Gretzky's statue and doing college basketball, among other things, for CBS. You could go Google Mike's resume. It's actually, he's a true person who really grinded his way up the business, did not have Hall of Fame playing credentials when he came in, and that's something I really respect. Mike, it's always great to talk to you. I appreciate your time today on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, Richard, I had a good time, and I wish you well with the podcast going forward.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Mike Mayock, who I think is an interesting guy, just from the way he's the way his career has sort of morphed. He did a lot of different things before he hit big nationally. Again, as I've said and written, easily the best NFL draft expert on television today. He's just, I you know, especially on that subject, he's just really interesting because you could tell the guy loves it. He's like son of a coach. He's a scout. Sort of, I like the nomenclature stuff, the X's and O's, because I learned something. All right, I'm bringing in Jamie Lasante to this conversation. Bette Marston is, I believe, either in the south of France or in Trinidad and Tobago or somewhere in the South Pacific. That's how Bette rolls. So she is somewhere on vacation. So we bring in the great Jamie Lasante. She's a tennis editor here. As well as, Jamie, what else do you do here? You edit The Edge, right? That's like the fitness section.
That is correct.
What else? What are your other responsibilities here?
We also do the tennis podcast.
The Brain on Sports podcast. You are John Wertheim's go-to person on that.
The SI Vault podcast.
I like that. Actually, that's an interesting one. Working with Ted Keith, God bless you. You've overcome that and still you're around here. All right, Jamie. So you just listened to Mike Mayock for 40 minutes or so. I'll tell you like just some stuff that just stuck out to me that was interesting. That Rick Majerus thing was really interesting that he actually – that's what's cool about it. Like jobs like that is you can actually sit in the stands because you're a television person. You have access – you know, they have the rights to the broadcast. So you can sit with a Patino – and a Majerus, and kind of watch how they do their thing. And that was really fascinating to me. I know you're a former college soccer player, that like Majerus was able to tell, because they weren't talking to each other on defense, on switches, right, that he would be able to attack something during a game. That was very I found that pretty interesting.
So did I. I mean, I remember practices when we'd get yelled at because the field was silent. So it's the same idea. And I think it's great that he brought up lots of teaching moments that he learned on the job. And I think, like you said, I enjoy those X's and O's and that kind of jargon because it brings something. I want to learn when I'm watching. I don't want to be kind of fed the same old.
Yeah, Tebow this, Tebow that, LeBron James this, LeBron James that. I'm with you. That's why I think Max excellent, but he was honest about the conversation about NBC. It's very clear that they made a decision to go with Doug Flutie over him. I think if you read between the lines, I don't know how you saw it, Jamie. I think it's clear that NBC management thought he talked too much or used too much of this jargon and went with a guy, I think, in Flutie, who they think is going to be more, I don't even know what the word is, you know, less jargony and more
He's
generic.
He's appealing to a mass audience.
Exactly.
Everyone knows the name. They know who he is.
Correct. And that's another thing, too, that Mayock sort of had to fight for his career. He's not Joe Montana. He's not Peyton Manning. He's not Doug Flutie. It was whatever he was, an eighth-round pick or something like that, who you played a cup of coffee in the NFL, and you wouldn't know him otherwise. All right. Let me just thank you guys once again for the great feedback that you've given on this podcast. The last three guests, Bomani Jones, Ian Dark, soccer commentator, and now Mike Mayock. Coming up, we will have David Shoemaker, who is Grantland's excellent wrestling writer that I'm really looking forward to. Katie Nolan is coming up in a couple weeks, the Fox Sports 1 personality. Fred Gadelli, who is the executive producer of Sunday Night Football. That should be interesting. He's coming up. And Mike Hill, the Fox Sports 1 host. I think he's hosting America's Pregame, worked for ESPN. He's an interesting guy as well. I look forward to him. You send any guest suggestions to me on Twitter at Richard Deitch. Any questions you want asked, feel free to criticize away. Join the rest of the Twitter crowd on that. If you like the show, please share it with your friends, and you can subscribe to this show or this podcast. I don't want to say show, Jamie. It is like a Broadway. You could subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. All right, wrapping up, our thanks to Mike Mayock for coming on today. My thanks to the great Jamie Lasante, killing it as Bette Marston's, not just interim replacement, I feel full-time replacement. I feel that this is one of those where she's come on and just basically won the U.S. Open in her first try. I'm Richard Deitch. We'll see you next time on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.